My name is Leon McGarity, and I am an alcoholic.
Hallelujah.
Roe was told me last evening, I guess, or the evening before, that he'd like to sit down when we had dinner together, and he'd see if he could find something good to say about me, and I sure was hoping he could, because it's not often he said anything good. Jack scared hell out of me last night. He mentioned that the Sunday morning speaker was supposed to be the spiritual speaker, and I said they must have tapped the wrong guy here for that. So I woke up early this morning, and I said, well, I guess I better get me a text here if I'm going to be the spiritual speaker. And I couldn't come up with a text, so I did have my old beat-up textbook, and I'm wondering if that'll work. It's the best that I'm going to do. But the only thing that I seem to know anything about, this old thing has been a lot of places, and it's been in a lot of meetings, and there's a lot of history behind this thing, but I'm not going to tell you about the history of this. It might be more interesting than my history, but this book has been a lot of places. It's about to fall all to pieces. I never heard of, before I forget it, though, I want to say thank you for Gwen. Most of you met Gwen here and myself for this wonderful weekend. The laughter and the fine people that we've met here, we'll treasure it. We've met so many people here in the past. I'd never heard of Mont Eagle, Tennessee until about a year ago. And I was sharing at a function in St. Louis, Missouri. And as the usual thing, if you do pretty good, they'll come up and hug you and shake your hand after you've done your thing. And here one guy come along and said, young man, he said, I don't want to hold up the line, but when you get through there, I'm going to step back and I want to talk to you just a moment. So he finally came over and he said, I know you. And as I did here this morning, I always use my full name at functions of the same. And he said, I was wondering where I knew you, but when you said the name McGarity, he said, I knew where I knew you from, and it's Mont Eagle, Tennessee. And that was the first time that I ever knew that there was such a place existed as Mont Eagle, Tennessee. And I said, I believe there is, maybe you've got me mixed with someone else. And he said, no, you're the hero. I knew I was in trouble then, because I'm sure no hero. There's a yellow streak down my back that wide. There's a bridge somewhere around Mont Eagle, Tennessee, that was named for you. I don't know what kind of hero he was talking about. And the clincher to it was that you were Buford Pusser's cousin. Someone asked me if I was a little nervous about getting up here this morning. And I was, but I wasn't near as nervous as I was until I asked someone, how many people is it here from Mont Eagle, Tennessee? So when I found out that there wasn't, that sort of relieved me a little bit. If there's anybody here from in around Buford Pusser's country or anywhere else, and you was known to traipse through the woods with a sack of sugar on your back, I want to tell you here and right now, I don't even know, never knew Buford Pusser, and I'm no kin to him. I want that perfectly understood. Perfectly understood. Tell you another thing, I've been 39 years old now for the last 36 years. I've had a little brain damage to begin with John Barleycorn, and again with the fact that I've just been here on this earth, I guess. My mind tells me sometimes to say some things, and when it gets translated back down here to where it's supposed to come out, it gets screwed up. I got in trouble down here right this side of Nashville coming in, and one of those things happened as they usually do with me, and I got to thinking about what this is going to be a fine weekend. This looks like real good country, and what I've heard of this is going to be wonderful. And I got to thinking about Gwen and feeling some appreciation for her, and I wanted to say something nice to her. And I turned to her, and my head said, tell her that she's one in a million. And rather than coming out as one as a million, by the time it got translated and come out here, I said, women like you are a dime a dozen. Diane and I celebrated our, not much, we didn't celebrate much last week, our 52nd, 52nd wedding anniversary. And we were sitting in our home, and I had one of those other feelings of gratitude for her, and all the things that she had put up with over the years, and the assistance she had been to me in getting sober, and her fine work with as a great spiritual advisor to the Al-Anon people in our area, you know, and I looked over and told her, I said, I'm proud of you. She turned and looked back at me, and she said, I'm tired of you, too. Get to some of my background, get into something serious now. Joe and Betty told me to say something. What did you say, Betty? Something important. So we're going to try to get around to that. I was born in Red Clay Hills, Mississippi. I have already told you how many years ago. My father was an alcoholic. And He was one of the best cotton farmers that I ever knew. But of course, in those days, there wasn't much cotton in Red Clay Hills of Mississippi, and he always wanted to go to the Delta country of Mississippi. And my mother loved the hills. She was a genuine hillbilly too, and she didn't want to leave. And my father promised her that if she would allow him to make the move and take the family and go to the Mississippi Delta, or he could raise cotton, he genuinely raised cotton, that he would quit drinking. And she finally agreed to it. And of course that didn't work either. The boll weevils got the cotton country in Mississippi in those days, and we found out that you could raise good cotton in northeast Arkansas, and the boll weevils hadn't got there. So the family, when I was baby almost, we moved to Mississippi County, Arkansas. And my father was a cotton farmer, loved to raise that cotton. Finally, when I was 16 years old, my father died of alcoholism. I don't think any of my family at that time had ever heard the term alcoholism. They had another descriptive term. It had a few more words involved with that as to what an alcoholic was. Uncle Charlie, as most people called him, had a great white shock of hair, wore the old Lyndon Johnson white hat, and he cut a big, beautiful figure on that Tennessee Walker out for the black people on the farms and stuff. But he just could not stay away from alcohol. We didn't know he was sick. We avoided him all we could. There was nowhere else to go. It was depression days, and the family had to stay together, and we didn't worry too much about who loved who. Was too damn busy trying to survive. And we didn't have a lot of problem with that. Some of this, I know Jim can relate to this. I found out when I got here, Jim and I was 5 miles apart, 4 miles apart part of that time, and so was his wife here. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. It happened in those days. My mother was very sickly, and I guess that most of the other children, there was 10 years between me and the next child to me, a brother, and they had, most of the time I can remember the family, most of them had married and had gone, left me and a sister just younger than I was. There I was with a drunken father, very sickly mother, this younger sister, and we knew all about poverty. We knew all about poverty. As Jim talked to Jim, we knew about Hoover hogs. We had to survive. It's what we call rabbits down there. We knew about split peas and split rice and eating those things. And we've heard of the wolf being at the door, and the wolf wasn't only at our door. She'd done come in, got behind the stove, and had puppies. After my father died, I part of my family had gone to Missouri, and they was farming and cotton ginning. So after my father died, I had in high school I had a scholarship or two. There was no way during those Depression days that I could go to school. I think that was one of my first resentments that I got, that the rest of the family didn't help out enough, at least I could be able to help my mother. They didn't help much with her. But they did get us up in Missouri. We got there. They put me at that very young age to managing the cotton gin. I went to school to learn to class cotton, and I started to class in cotton, and I started buying cotton. Cotton that we did there. And way out in the country, and I was always pretty tense. I had a little more than that than I could handle there. So my drinking just continued at that young age to go along, to continue to progress. See, I told you it won't get from here to the right thing sometime. With the things that had happened in my life, the sickly mother, the younger sister that I was having to take with, and what had happened to in my life, I took on that victimization thing that we hear about so much, and I carried that for so many years that I was a victim, and if I had to put up with what I had to put up and the way I was brought up, and I got cheated out of my education and all those things, my God, you would drink too if you had that to go through with. And by the time I got into AA, I think the first thing that somebody had done was open this big book to page 62 and said our problem was selfishness and self-seeking. Put it in my ballpark, didn't they? Put it right in my ballpark. I think when I told you that my name's Leon and I'm an alcoholic, that they say that's what qualifies you to be here. I think what qualified me to be here more than anything else was when I decided that I had a desire to stop drinking. And I was willing to do what was necessary in order not to drink anymore. Up to that time, I had been swearing off day in and day out, and day in and day out, and I meant every word of it. And that wasn't working. It did not work. But it seemed like when I come to AA, and the first thing that I learned was that I would do what was necessary in order not to drink, that was a completely different attitude. It changed things, and something happened to me when I did those things. Another thing I think that qualifies me to be up here that I do know about that swearing off, and I know what happens when you do that. I know the results of swearing off. I know about spiders, and you know you get out in Splat Saturday out here and you start talking about spiders. They don't even know what you're talking about. My alcoholism had got to the point that I'd start looking in the grass and in hiding places, and we have those. There was always one or two little old spiders, right, and about two or three drops of spiders that turned that little old thing up and drag on that thing to just get one taste of it on your tongue. There's not many people that can relate to that, but when I come into AA, I found people who could relate to that. I know all about nut houses and jitter joints. In my days and days, we didn't have treatment centers. I called them jitter joints. That was what they was. I know about waking up in the middle of the night with those sweats, reasons of death, and pull a sheet up on you and then burning out, pushing that thing back off. Freeze to death again, and I know about the dry heaves. I think all of you, maybe most of you can relate to that. I know about the people that walked around us and talked about that all we needed was willpower. Me and my wife had a small business out there. It wasn't big enough that we could hire enough help, and we couldn't pay enough to help that they did hire them to stay there with us. And between the two of us, we damn near worked ourselves to death for 30-something years. She'd have to have some rest sometime, and she'd go home, and she'd tell what employees we had, the ones I hadn't fired, that she had to go back out and hire back to get them back. And she'd say, you get on the phone. If he slips out of here, you see any way that he's going to get out of here to get him a drink of booze or anything, you call me and let me know. She'd call the liquor stores and say, you know, he's in trouble already and you better not sell him anything. You might get sued. She'd call the police station and said, if you see him on the road, he's drunk and you can get him for DWI. She had all forces marshaled against me to not get a drink. Who would you put your money on? Who would you put your money on?
No.
I can relate to, and I'm sure you can too, is something I heard early on when I come into AA about a little old guy that was what we used to call winos. He was shuffling down the street. It was a cold, very cold winter day, and the ice was about this thick, and he had on that old ragged, heavy overcoat, and he shuffled into this liquor store, got him that little old bottle of port wine, and eased back out, and about the time he hit that ice, he fell right flat on his side down in the street, and he looked out there. Some of that red stuff was trickling off into the gutter out there, and he said, "Damn, I hope that's blood." You can tell I've got an allergy. I saw Jim Beam and Dickel or Dickel. I never drink under that stuff. Must have activated my allergy. Just seeing the sign down the road. Also know that you can relate with me the fact that this vacuum, as some people call a hole in their gut or a monkey on their back or whatever, that nothing will seem to fill other than another drink of alcohol. And I know you can relate to that. But that's not alone, those things is not the only thing that qualifies me to be up here. And I think the main thing that qualifies to me to be here is that I have found a successful solution to the problem of alcoholism. It was passed on by Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, and the people before them, the people like you that's been around the tables that came before I did. I'd like to tell you one thing before I start too, that I can't tell you Bill Wilson's story. I'm not Bill Wilson, I'm Leon McGarity, and I'm going to tell you my story. I was speaking some time ago at a place, and someone piped up out in the back and said, "That's not what Bill Wilson said about it." So that's the reason for my point telling you I'm not telling Bill Wilson's story. Since this is a spiritual meeting, I shouldn't tell this, you know. I found out in AA very early on that we are what we think. And by the time I got here, I always thought we are what we eat. I had an uncle that was, he never ate anything in his life but dog food. And he lived until he was 93 years old. And he was in good health all the time, and he was even in good health when he died. And the way he died, he was trotting down the road one day, and he dropped down in the road to lick himself, and a car ran over him and killed him. You can use that if you want to. World War II came along during those days. I missed the first draft by 10 days. Second draft got the 18-year-olds. Third draft got the older people and the 21-year-olds. I was number 27 in my county that was pulled out of the thing, and from that day to this, I've never heard from a draft board. I don't know what happened. I never did go back checking with them either. I didn't. It left me down in that country, in that cotton country down there, with all those old men and all those pretty girls, and Gwen was one of those pretty girls. And that was how we met. I was working at a bank at the time, and I decided I wasn't making enough money in the bank, and they wasn't anywhere near to hiding my booze, and so I went over to a part of town with one of the gang members around that country, and we went and partnered together and put us in a joint, if you will. Gwen had a boyfriend who was in the service, and his brother would bring a lot of their girls down, and those girls down from another town up north, and that's where we met. And so we got married, and by that time I was having to get a little black market booze out of Chicago, and had a little financing deal with a guy going bring get some tires out of Chicago. They'd get an old Plymouth and take the back seat out of it, and they'd stack those tires in there. And they'd get a gal with a little boy or girl, get them in the front seat with them, put them a stroller, put a blanket over it, put a stroller on it, put that liquor down in the hole that those tires left there, and they could come through. Some of them got caught. Some of them told them that I was doing the finances. They thought I was the big boss behind that. I didn't have that many finances to get big boss. One day they stopped me out on the road out there, and it was the OPA, the FBI, the Highway Patrol, and everybody else, and I wasn't too sure that where I was going, and I happened to have some of that black market liquor that come out of Chicago. I had a case of old black gold. I took it up to the prosecuting attorney and asked him if he couldn't help me out in this deal, so I haven't heard from those people either, other than the fact that it was just getting a little bit too hot around there, and Gwen decided that we'd go and we'd get patriotic and go north and get into the war movement to help and produce some of that stuff that they needed over there. By that time, I was like the guy that booze had got was getting me pretty good. And I remembered the guy up there one time that I didn't know about alcoholism then. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I thought I just liked to drink. I think that what my attitude was about people who drank was like the guy that was at the psychiatrist one time. The psychiatrist asked him, told him, said, I want to start with you. I want to find out about what you do with your day. And the old boy told him, said, well, where do I start? He said, what's the first thing you do every morning? He said, well, I guess I wake up. And the psychiatrist told him, said, that's fine. Now, then what do you do? And he said, well, I get up. And he said, that's fine. You're doing great. What do you do next? And he said, I throw up. And the psychiatrist said, my God, every morning? And he said, hell yes, doesn't everybody? That was about the way I was with that. I didn't like the North. We went north in a convertible coupe, of all things. Had to dig that thing out of snow every morning, and I had to come back. I just had to get out of there, and the jobs was frozen. And I pulled a few strings and got them to release me, and we headed back. And there was a fellow in Blyville, Arkansas, that had been an accountant with the cotton gins and stuff and so forth. And it was a food manufacturing company that came in, was just starting. And they knew that they could expand after the war when they could get the equipment and get the rolling equipment and stuff to do so. And so they called me from up there to, if I could get away, to come back down. Gwen and I came back down, and I took over that job, and we moved out into housing was a problem in those days. So the government had allowed them. There was an air base in Blyville, and it allowed them to build some houses out in the sand. Out in one part of the town out there, and not a tree anywhere. There wasn't, lawns wasn't up. It was just out in the hot, boiling sun. So we moved out there with a bunch of young people. Right away, I joined the Junior Chamber of Commerce there, and in those days, we was putting on the National Cotton Picking Contest. We made them enough money out of that thing to build us a nice clubhouse there in town, and the first thing we put in that was a bar. The next thing was a crap table, and the next thing was some slot machines. So I spent most of my time down at the J.C. Club Room. We socialized with those young people for quite some time, and then in the social life, it got to where sometimes I'd me and Gwen in the evening after I would get in, and she decided, well, let's don't go tonight. I said, she must be getting sick or something wrong with her. Is she pregnant again, or what's wrong with her? And it suddenly dawned on me that she was being embarrassed by the way I acted with those things, and I would throw a real fit then. I'd say, by God, they get drunk too, and they act just like I do. They show their ass just like I do. And that went on for quite some time. I was expected to travel around a good bit, help build that business and opening routes for that company for quite some time. I was expected to drink with other people, which God knows I loved that. I had an expense account, and you know I loved that. Just got too successful. So there was another company that decided they wanted to buy us out to keep us from stepping on their toes. They bought us out. They bought me, and I saw just as soon as I got there that they wasn't going to put up with the drunk, and I didn't think that I could get along with those people. So Colonial Bread in Memphis had an opening, and they asked me to come to Memphis with Colonial Bread. We was there some time. I worked as a route builder for Colonial Bread, and we're really doing fine. It's the first time I'd really been outside doing a little manual stuff, and was feeling good. I don't think I progressed as bad as I did at that time, and I got sick one time. And they was putting a little too much pressure on me anyhow, and it wound up that we got into a little something, and I quit. Didn't even have a job, and I hadn't been like that in many years. So I went back to Missouri where my family was, with the farms and the cotton gins. And that was where we wound up. Fast food business and the Dairy Queen business and those little things was getting real good in those days. So we put in, there was two people was putting in one of those things. They was with Texas Eastern Oil Company. They was putting their money in. They wanted someone to run those things, one of those things for them there. I had an uncle who was in the barbecue business, and he had told them, said, Leon's down here and Gwen's down here. Maybe they'll get this thing started for you. And till you can find someone to take it over full time, give them something to do. They're just laying around. We told them we would. But long story short was that we wound up buying the thing, and we were stuck there for 30-something years. Never did make enough money there. Never did look so progressive that anybody wanted to buy it. Wasn't no way to get it. Wasn't no way to get out of it. During those years, we worked so hard, and I found out that there was a liquor store right down the road, about 100 yards down the road. And we had to put in long hours, not much good help. I'd traipse down with a little half a pint every now and then. Wasn't long till I was hiding it here and yonder and everywhere. Began to quit doing the job for me. Alcohol, John Barleycorn, can certainly change a person's attitude. I drank, alcohol was my answer to my problem for so many years. And I didn't want to give up the fact that I had to give up my only friend that was filling that vacuum that I needed filling during that time. John Barleycorn kept working on me. You know, it's this change of attitude, there's certain circumstances that'll certainly change your attitude. I heard about this lady that she was driving along the street one day in her Mercedes, and she was passing this fancy hotel, and her Mercedes and her sable coat and her fancy diamonds, she looked over at the door and she saw her husband go in with a sweet young thing. Right away she parked that Mercedes and scooted into the lobby, and she waited for him. She sat there and she waited, and finally he come down. He said, just hold it just a minute, don't get too hefty with me. Said, you, those diamonds that you're wearing, that sable coat and that Mercedes, said, this is the lady and her sister that owns the business, has given us the business, and we can make that kind of money to support you in the way you're being supported. And about that time, his partner walked in with another pretty young thing, and she said, look at there, he's doing it too. And he said, well, that's this girl's sister. And he's doing the same thing I'm doing. She said, ours is prettier than his, isn't she? Up until this time, booze hadn't been that much of a problem to me. Gwen had an alcohol problem, namely me. It was a big problem for Gwen. And that was when I began to fight the stuff. One day I was driving around, and I just almost felt like I was going to pieces. We didn't have a hospital in our town at that time, but there was 5 hospitals in Poplar Bluff, Missouri. I had 2 friends, 2 brothers that was doctors over there that I drank with, and I thought maybe I'd go see those 2 guys, and maybe they could tell me what the hell's wrong with me. They drank. They wasn't like I was. So I went over and talked to them. And it so happened that their brother, their sister, and other members of their family had died of alcoholism, and they knew something about alcoholism. Got me on the table and laid me on the table, and Jim took my hand and pushed down on my stomach there. He said, do you feel that right there? And I said, yeah, what is it? He said, that's your liver, as hard as a damn rock, isn't it? And I said, it sure is. And that scared me to death. I'd heard of cirrhosis of the liver, but I knew then that maybe I just got to have cirrhosis of the liver and I'm goner from here on out. They decided that maybe tranquilizers was just coming in. Then they thought maybe that they would try me on some tranquilizers. But one thing the tranquilizers didn't do for me what alcohol did for me. It just didn't do it, so I didn't stick with the Librium. They put me on Librium at that time. Told my wife, don't ever tell anybody why I'm going from the business. Somebody will find out I'm at that hospital over there, but be sure that they don't know other than anything that maybe it's my nerves. They know why I work too damn hard, and it's my nerves. It rocked along the end till I just kept drinking, kept getting sicker and sicker. Gwen kept getting sicker and sicker. She kept enabling by keeping the business going when I wasn't there. She didn't know any better, of course. Can't hold that against her. One time, there were some friends that were still back from down in Pemiscot County down there, where I was at the bank. We had the joint down there, the sheriff in particular. They were duck hunters. And every December, they would get together. There was a bachelor doctor down there that lived. He had a freestanding building there. He lived alone in the back of that. He had a real nice place in the back of it. He had his office up in the front. He was a member. He was a part of this duck hunting deal. And the sheriff was his cook. And they would have this party, just stag party, every year. And the ducks and the booze would really fly. They called me. We wanted me down there. They just like to have anybody drink like they did. They didn't want to feel guilty, you know. So they called me to come down. And I said, I'm pretty tied up today. Don't have enough help. I don't believe I can get there and back. They said, well, most of them had light planes. They said, what if we had a good little airport there? He said, what if we fly down and pick you up and fly you back? And I said, I can arrange it. I went out, parked my car, and they came in. We went back, landed, and it was everybody really got drunk. We come back in sometime through the night. I don't remember the trip, but I do remember getting out of the plane and saw the beacon, watched to see that they got off, turned to get back to my car, and the lights went out. What had really happened, someone had taken one of those airplane chocks, one of those wooden airplane chocks, and caught me right between the eyes. Somebody saw my car out there, I guess. Somebody had stepped on their toes, maybe, and that they wanted to get some revenge, and they damn well done it. So by 7 o'clock the next morning, I think it was, Gwen was calling down there to see what was happening to me and couldn't find me. She sent the police out, and I'd sit there and I'd ooze blood most of the night, I guess, sitting there at that, and they took me into my doctor, who had a small clinic there, put me in one of the rooms back there and told Gwen to go get him some clothes, said we don't want him to get out of here looking like that. So got me dried up at that time. And this doctor, after he had finished his day, he's French Canadian. We had an alcoholic priest there who was a good friend of his, and myself. And I had a little lower back problem, and Father Slay had a lower back problem. And we'd get a fifth apiece, and we'd go down to the doctor's office after office hours, and he'd keep one girl there, and he'd put some kind of heat or light or something on us, and the three of us would sit there and get drunk. So the doctor and Father Slade decided that I needed to go somewhere and do something about my alcoholism. The doctor never was alcoholic. He drank a lot, but he never was alcoholic. Father Slade finally died. So Father Slade said there's a place in St. Louis called St. Vincent's, and it was run by the Daughters of Charity. I don't know where they got that name. If you pay the bill, I don't know. It didn't sort of fit the name, but they did. It was a great place. It was a great, great place. I stayed there for about 30 days. And it was the first time in my life that they took all the sharp things, including my nail clippers and everything else. You had to have a key to get out down to the elevator. Got me a psychiatrist. They started feeding me up. 16 or 18 insulin shock treatments. They kept me there for that time, and the psychiatrist would come in every day, and I can see him with that pipe today. He'd come in and sit down in my room with me. Had the best smelling tobacco I ever smelt in my life. That's the only thing I really know about that psychiatrist. But he would sit there and he wouldn't open his mouth, and he'd sit there and look at me. And he'd finally get up and leave. It would maybe exchange a little something. And that went on all during that time. I laced those Indian moccasins and shook. I made those little old ashtrays with those little square mosaic tile things and shook. But I did eat. It had a little four-hole golf course. This thing was only about 350 acres out there. It had a little four-hole golf course out there. They played it as nine, you know, and had nice trees and benches out there, and me and the other various nuts out there. We'd sit on those benches, and we'd see the people walking out through that beautiful place, you know, and we'd try to decide which was the psychiatrist and which was the nuts, you know. Always wrong. We missed them every time. I came back from there, fed up. Gwen says, looking good. Got right back in business and it was doing fine. Didn't even want to drink. That psychiatrist told me when I left there, he said, when the occasion arises, business reasons, social reasons, or whatever, don't you ever take over one or two or three drinks. Well, he said, that's what I do. And he said, I think you need a hobby, and I would suggest that you take up golf. He said, that's very relaxing. That's what I do. Already had a hobby. Had one long time. It went 6 or 7 months there that it never crossed my mind that I wanted to drink. I never thought anything about that I'm through forever. I never thought about anything I'll ever want to drink. I just didn't want to drink. One night, along about Christmas time then, an old friend had an automobile. He had a Buick agency there, and he had sold a Buick agency and going into a Studebaker agency down there. And he had his Christmas party every day year. And he said, you know, you come to our Christmas party every year. I said, I know you don't drink, but said, the rest of us do. We sure would like to have you come down. I said, when I get through tonight, I'll come down, and I'll stay a little while because I want to see all my friends down there, but I'm not drinking. I got down there, and somehow or another, out of the clear blue sky, I decided to drink and taste pretty good. I went up to the bartender, and I said, pour me 1 ounce in a tall glass, put some ice in it, and put white soda in it to the very top, make it weak. And I drank that one drink. And the head said, you better get home. It hadn't hit enough then, but I did. I headed home, and it was getting a little late. I was removing my clothes, and Gwen said, she can smell it over the telephone if I'm in California. She said, you have been drinking. And I said, by God, after all I have done for you, I stayed in that damn jitter joint up there for 30 damn days. I've come back and I've worked here for 6 or 7 months, and I go out and have one lousy little old drink, and you've got to open your mouth. Pulled my clothes right back on and went right back down there. Was the drink? I was drunk to end all drunks. I wound up somewhere. I really don't know how many days I was gone there, 3 or 4, I guess. Don't remember a whole lot about it. I remember being on the Arkansas-Missouri state line where the gangsters run the crap tables and the gambling joints down there that is paying off the people in order to do it. I remember counting at one time during that time, counting up, I had about $1,200 on them. And after I counted that money, I don't remember anything else until I came to upstairs in a motel, looked out the window. Here it is, all the day before Christmas Eve, and you can imagine how many people in a small town motel on that time of day, nobody out there, what in the hell am I doing in the second story drunk as I'd been all that time? And I didn't know where I was, and there was a matchbook in the ashtray, of course, and I was back within 20 miles of home, the El Capri Motel. I got to looking for my money, that $1,200 sure wasn't there, and I was dying for a drink, and I said, God knows I've got to have a drink. And I got to looking around to see if I'd brought anything with me. And there was one, I would never, for some reason, ever drink Old Crow whiskey. It was something about Old Crow that turned me off. And I walked around, and I pulled a door back here by the bathroom, and there sat a pint bottle of Old Crow. And I'm sure I didn't take it there, but there's about this much taken out of it at the time. And I said, thank you, God. Opened that old bottle, I wasn't even... could have been anything in it. I went in and put the top down on the commode and sat down there, and I was shaking so bad I'd having trouble getting the top off of that thing. And I decided if I could get it poured into the glass, that maybe I could get it down. It kept beating the top of that glass, finally broke a little thin glass, broke apart off of that, and then I finally had to try to make it with the just out of the bottle. Got enough of it down and got enough of it to stick till so I was going to have to get out of there. Those people, I didn't even know those people in the motel. They didn't know me. I didn't have any money. Now, how am I going to get out of here? And I remembered a friend there in town, and I called him and told him. I said, Len, I'm up here at the Kel Capri. I knew he was friends with these people. And I said, you're going to have to tell them to take my check because I'm up here and I can't get out. And he said, I'll be up there in a minute. So he came on, lived right close. We went down. He got me out of the hotel. But in the meantime, I called the business. Please, God, don't let her answer. You ever go out in the garage and have your car hit and something out there around the car and get down behind the car and get that top off of it and turn it up, and when you get up here there are two eyes looking at you? Please God don't let her answer. And one of the boys that worked there did answer, and I said, Joe, I'm over at El Capri in Saxton. Come and get me. Bring somebody to bring the car back. I don't believe I can drive. For God's sakes, don't bring Gwen. Who do you think showed up? We got home, and I knew I was sick. I knew then I was very, very sick. And I made some more promises. And it's been so long, but I think it was at that time that Gwen agreed that I was sick. And I do remember it sometime along the line, she told me that I know you're sick, which was a different tack that she was taking. But said, if you will do whatever is necessary, again, she didn't know the nomenclature at that time, but that's what came out. If you will do what's necessary in order to quit drinking, evidently she had read something or something, then I'll do anything I can to help you. She wasn't in an Al-Anon. You knew nothing about Al-Anon. There wasn't no Al-Anon around. So I made my promises again. Pretty well knew how sick I was. Got back on another one, and they wouldn't take me back up at St. Louis. They said, we don't want him to die on us. Send me down to Gartley Rams in Memphis. And I really remember going into to Gartley Rams and again, get me in bed, decided and said, do you want to taper off? And I'd already come to the point that I knew I couldn't live with alcohol or live without it, so if I started tapering off, I'd taper back on just sure as hell. And I decided to take the odds. And I said, no, I don't want to taper off. They got me in my room, and about that time, they brought a guy, and I can still see that guy. They had four people, one on each arm, two on each foot. Beautiful blue suit on, dragging it, taking him down that hallway to somewhere, and here come a nurse behind with a bottle and one of those little brown bags, and I changed my mind. I said, that looks like just my brand. I believe I'd better taper off. I said, no, you've done made your decision. Well, they started me out in physical therapy. Those people feed you about like we've been fed up here this weekend. I'll tell you, they fed good too. They got me to feeling pretty good. And Gwen would come down, and finally one day she said, you're going to have to leave here someday. I'm going to catch a bus and go home. I'm going to leave you the car, and if you think that you're going to do what's necessary now and get with it, come home. And if you're not, head wherever you want to go. And that's the way she left it. So I'd made up my mind at that time, I'm not going to drink anymore. So I headed home, and I made it to Blavel, Arkansas, and out of a clear blue sky, for no reason at all, I just decided I'd drink. It tastes pretty good about now. And any time that I decided that a drink would taste pretty good about now, that's when I took a drink. I'm afraid if that happened today, the same thing might happen. I'm pretty sure it would. So then it kept escalating, and it kept progressing, and it'd get worse and worse and worse. And so one day, I just couldn't get to work. I just couldn't get to work. She went on down, still doing her enabling, opened up the business to make some money for me to buy some whiskey with. There was an old friend that had lost his business there in Dexter. He had a business, had a nice home out on the golf course. He had two boats, two luxury automobiles, a nice family. He'd lost it all. And he had finally wound up in Little Rock at what they call the Little Rock Approach Plant. And he had a sponsor there. They put him with a sponsor, a guy named Mark. And he told Gwen what had happened, and he asked her, said, "Where's Leon?" She said, "He's at home sick." And he said, "Yeah, Bourbon Chill." She said, "Yes." Said, "I want to talk to him." And she said, "We'll go." And so they sat down by this bed where I'm shaking. And he told me the story about the Little Rock Approach Plan to Mark. Said, "He is my sponsor. I'll get in touch with him. Said, I believe he'll sponsor you down there. Would you like to go down there to Little Rock?" My head started to do this, you know, and I saw Gwen's head doing this, and rather start another fad, I'd done like this too. The most horrible trip that I ever made in my life was from Dexter, Missouri to Little Rock, Arkansas. She wouldn't let me even get a beer. We can get a 7-Up, we can get a milkshake. Everyone gets some ice water, and we made it down, and I couldn't even get all the way over to Little Rock. We stopped out there in an old hotel, motel out there in North Little Rock, about as far as I could go. And we called this Mark, and he said, "I'll be out there." Mark came out and stayed out there till almost 11 o'clock that night. And it made more sense than any human that I ever heard in my life. And he told me about the Little Rock Approach Plan. I guess most of you know about the Little Rock Approach Plan. This is where some person had written a, sort of rewritten the big book, I guess, an attorney over there, that something I think they called the number one clinic group. And when you went into that, they took over your life. That was God. And they put you through those paces, and you followed their dictates. And they had this dormitory where they kept those people. So we went out there. Met a guy named Neil out there, and Neil began to tell me about his 8 drink-up wives. I heard that got started at 5, 4, 5, 6 there. They got bigger every time he told the story, but that's that's alcoholics. They told me I could stay there. But said, "You'll have to maybe have to wash dishes, make beds, clean floors, or do something like this, make the coffee," and they'll say. But they decided that maybe you're too damn sick to stay here, and maybe you better go back and get some more hospitalization, and then we'll take you back. So Gwen hauled me back home. But there was something different about that even, because they was talking about the first drink and the allergy and what happened, and I was thinking to myself all the way back home, I'm not going to have to drink anymore. I know about this allergy, and I'm not going to put that first drink in there. And then this allergy won't activate, and I won't have to drink anymore. And I went along there about a week knowing that glad to know that there was somebody else in the world like me, and that I wasn't the only one, and that I wasn't a moral degenerate. But I was right out to the back one day doing something there, and out of the clear blue sky for no reason at all. So I drank, it tastes pretty good about now. Just 1,000 yards, about 100 yards or so down to this liquor store. I tripped back down my little path, back down there again. I got me a 1/2 pint, and that's all I was going to drink. And I come back. That started the ball rolling all over again. And it just kept getting worse, and it kept getting worse. I had a place in town, and we called 1 Mile Road. And it had some kind of a drainage ditch beside it, and willows growing along it. And this was the point where I was getting desperate. I was really getting desperate. Gwen was in bad shape, crying. I got up real early one morning because I was starting to shake, and I didn't like anybody to see me shake. Woke her up, and I told her, I said, "You told me that if I didn't drink, you'd be the happiest person in the world. I'm giving you that present today. This is the day." So I started back out. I told her, "I've got to get out early. I've got some motors broke down or something. Something I had to do out there to get out early." And I went out on 1 Mile Road where I had me some particular willows that I knew where I kept the little 1/2 pint bottle that sat along there. The city had got out early in the morning. It was real hot summertime, and it let them go out real early in the morning, knock off through the heat of the day. And damn, they hadn't gone out there by sunup, and they'd got my willows. And I couldn't find my booze. And there I sat, no liquor stores open or anything, and I sat there out there on 1 mile road, and then I guess my first idea that there might be a God was right out there. And I was shaking. And I said, if God hadn't wanted me to drink like this, why in hell did he give me this horrible appetite? That was as sincere as anything I ever said in my life. So, after I'd promised Gwen, I wound up, of course, but late that evening, around 7 o'clock, I couldn't find it with a hay rake. Prior to that, in the town of Poplar Bluff, which is 25 miles away, they had a daily paper. In our little town in them days, we only had a weekly newspaper. But the daily paper, there was a little classified ad in there. And it said, if you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to quit, that's our business. So I got on the phone. I decided I'd better call and see what that's all about. And I couldn't get the number straight or anything else, and so a friendly operator, I guess, that knew something, I finally found out who that operator was, put me in touch with a fellow by the name of Joe. Joe had been sober since 1952. Joe was in braces. He had a horrible wreck going to an AA meeting. Some people had got killed. But speaking of a sense of humor this morning, Joe always called his braces being all tied up with them damn coat hangers, he called it. But Joe was a brilliant man on one side of his head, and he was a genuine kook on the other side. But he was just what I needed. And I got on that phone to Joe, and I was so drunk, but I was poured it out to him. And he said, we have a man in your town that started our meetings here. And said, a railroad man has been having to drive over there to get him every Monday night. But the railroad man is in the railroad hospital in Little Rock and can't do it, and said, this is great. Do you have a car? And I said, damn right, a big one and a good one. Had to let him know that I wasn't a Skid Row bum, you know. I had to let him know that for sure. And he said, maybe you could bring him over here. And I said, well, you know, that'd be good, because I know that guy and he really needs it, but I don't want you to get him in touch with me, because in the weekly paper here, I see Donnie Kay's name in there all the time where he stole a battery or a tire or something. And Joe told me, you know, I've talked to you enough to know that you're in business. And if you ever got to the point where you needed a drink bad enough that you would have stole to get you a drink or run your credit or something? And I didn't have to finish answering that, because if Gwen hadn't been enabling, of course, at that time, she was the only one that had let me to stay into the booze. And I think that was my first introduction to But for the Grace of God. I was looking down at little Donnie there. So here come Donnie down, as I called to them damn little old pamphlets, you know. And I told him to get ready, and I got the best threads that I had to go to that AA meeting. I'll tell you, I fixed up, shined my car up good, so somebody wouldn't think I was an alcoholic. And we got down the road just about to that little old liquor store that I'd been traipsing back and forth to down there all the time. I said, Donnie, I owe this old boy for that last drink that I bought. And I said, I don't want to keep him waiting. I'm going to run in here and pay him for that drink. And I said, you don't need to go in these places like I do. Gwen let me have $5 before I left. She knew I couldn't get too drunk on $5, but I spent $1.50 for that, for a little old half pint of whiskey, and got enough courage to get into that meeting down there. That left me $3.50 after I got there. This guy that was in the braces said that you're not supposed to be in a meeting if you're drinking within the last 24 hours. But I know that you'll sit still and say nothing, and we don't have any place to put you. He said, you go over there and sit down and listen. I'll talk to you after the meeting. I'll talk to you before the meeting. I don't know how long I went to that meeting just like that. I could not get the alcohol out of my system, and they knew it. They knew how sick I was. That's the reason I don't know my anniversary of my last drink. I don't know. I don't know when it was. It just one day, it seemed like I don't need to take this drink. I just don't need that drink anymore. Went to that group meeting. It was an Episcopal church, a small Episcopal church, a very small Episcopal community in that country, in that town. Had between 80 and 100 members in it, but they let us meet there for all during that time. And That was our group for a long time. We decided about a year after that that we might need another meeting, and there was two or three others that we started that meeting in Dexter. One of the things that I found out from when I got into that meeting was something about the disease of alcoholism. Joe explained the disease of alcoholism to me. He talked about the allergy, and I'd almost figured it out on my own by just drinking it, that it was something. What I'd heard down at that dormitory that was the first drink done it, I found out from Joe it wasn't the first drink that done it. It was the attitude that I was in that caused me to want to take that first drink. I found that from Joe. Joe was so good for me. There was another guy that I took on as a co-sponsor that when I'd get so damn mad at Joe and I couldn't stand him and wanted to kill him, I could go to Earl, and he was a little more politic with me that he could that we could get along a little better. Earl was the guy that gave me a little thing to put in my book. Or I did put it in my book. I wrote it in the front of that $3.50 book, that you cannot think your way into sober living, but you can live your way into sober thinking. And Earl was the first guy that I ever said that action is the magic word. And he made that. He also told me something else at that time. He said they was talking about God, and intellectualizing God is procrastination. And it's still in that book. Those things is in that book. You act your way into sober thinking. Joe told me that the big book don't tell you much about getting sober. It tells you about staying sober. He said there's about only one place that he knows in the first 64 pages that talks much about the first step, and that was says if you hadn't made up your mind yet, go out and get you a bottle and try it, and try it more than once. But he said, I'm going to pass something along to you that he called gimmicks. They'll show you how to stay off of it maybe until you can get you some AA under your belt. And he mentioned to me about the little card and the Serenity Prayer. And he said, if you'll use that, it'll help a lot. And he said, I think you ought to associate with other alcoholics. He said, come to as many meetings as you can. Thank God he didn't say 90 and 90. But come to as many as you can and associate with these people. Earl said it helps to say, ask for help in the morning and say thank you at night. But each time those people was telling me that was to be sure that I understood that that wasn't substitutes for the 12 steps and the action of the program. And he said, concentrate on the solution rather than alcohol. And don't concentrate on that redhead and that pretty redhead and that blonde over there. Said, under every skirt there's a slip, and when the redhead walks in, sobriety walks out a lot of times. So it reminded me of a guy I heard here a while back. He was going through a town, and he went to a new place to an AA meeting, and there's some old boy standing here in the meeting there, and he had some calling cards. He wasn't giving them to the men. He was just giving them to the ladies. And this guy walked up to him and asked him, he said, what are you doing? And he handed him one of the cards, and it said on there, if you want to get laid, call 555-2645. If you want to get sober, get yourself a female sponsor. The guy said, man, what the hell are you doing that for? He said, you'll be surprised how many calls I get. I would have brought a calendar, Jack. I don't need a watch. I tell you, it gets me too far here. But I did get into the solution that time. And I had people that they wasn't what I'd call big book slappers. Joe said he didn't want to be Bill Wilson either. He wanted to be Joe Hayes. And he would share with me his experience and how he found out who he was. And he gave me the opportunity to do that. He was one of the best friends that I've ever had. And he told me, I think one of the main things that he told me about was the problem that I was having, being a good old hillbilly from Mississippi. Grandfather was an old Bible-slapping Baptist preacher. Family was all Baptist. And when he talked about God, I began to think about that old Baptist thing that my family had brought up with and that I didn't care much about in the past. And I talked to Joe about the third step. And he said, I want to tell you something about my experience. And my experience is, and the way I read the book was, that there was something in that third step that you hear so much about people wanting to make a religion out of this program, have taken the same attitude that you think you're getting out of this attitude here that you're talking to me about. And he said, if this was like church, the third step would have read, we turned our laughing well over the care of God as we understood him. And he said, if you'll just read the black stuff and figure out what the black stuff says there, you'll find out what I'm talking about. And that was when I remembered, back when I was a very young child, and my father, the alcoholic, he'd get a few drinks, get the kids around, and start giving us little problems and logic and things of that sort about the three frogs on the lily pad. My dad did that when I was a very young child. And, of course, he'd ask if one of them decided to jump, how many was left. And, of course, our answer was always two. And he'd say, well, he didn't jump, he just decided to jump. And that's my third step. Earl passed it along to me. See, I drank too long. I lost my train of thought. I'll get with it. Get with it in a minute. Earl was the guy that talked to me about, he didn't feel like that he was a AA member until he had made that decision, the third step, that made him an AA member. And he called my attention to a very important person in my life that I never knew, don't know who he is or who he is, but he was in the big book and his name was Fred. And Fred was the guy that was the accountant that went to New York, Washington, and had so much trouble before he got back, and Bill and his people had seen him. And he was gone for quite some time. They had already talked to him, and he said with the knowledge that he had got from those guys seeing him the first time, he thought he could handle it, just as I did when I'd gone down to those people at Little Rock in the approach plan. And he showed me, he told me to read about the part that happened to him, what happened to Fred. And I read in there that Fred said, the moment I made up my mind to go through with this process, I had the curious feeling that my alcohol condition was relieved, as it later proved to be. I don't know, from my standpoint, I don't know of a better third step anywhere. I know of no better third step anywhere. Joe talked to me about the little Chinese finger trick that you used to get out of popcorn when I was a kid, their little tubular thing. It was platted out of the reeds. Kids would stick their finger in them, and you'd tell them to pull back, and the harder you pulled, the tighter they got. You turn them loose, they'd fall off their own accord. Third step. Earl passed on to me about on page 159, I think he was either number three or number four in AA, the guy that said, after they'd gone to see him a number of times. And he said, what you guys say about this spiritual program makes sense to me. I'm ready to do business. No better third step, in my opinion, than anybody will ever take. That is my way of taking the third step. And I don't think you took the third step unless you got a pencil and paper and sat. I'm going to do the fourth step. That doesn't mean you're going to do it. It just means I may put it off. I'm going to get around to it. That doesn't work. You've either made the decision or you don't. And it was so simple to me, the way Joe put it to me. It wasn't simple to me. It was very, very complicated. I had a real lesson recently in complicating things, as I usually do. I was up the Lake of the Ozarks in central Missouri, beautiful place, beautiful lodges up there. Early October, the leaves was turning, and that lake is just beautiful up there. And I woke up that morning and left the lodge. Walked down by the water, the sun was coming up, and there was a flight of geese coming across. And you know how geese fly in that V shape? And there was an old fisherman out there, and he brought his boat up there. And he said, it's a beautiful morning, isn't it? And I said, it sure is. He said, I see you're enjoying that. You must be a city boy. And I said, no, I'm not a city boy, but I'm still enjoying this. He said, did you see that beautiful flight of geese that just went over? And I said, that's what I was looking at. He said, did you notice that one arm of that V, that it's longer than the other one? I said, I sure did. Why is that? Why, he said, there's more geese in it. AA program was simple. But it finally dawned on me, but what they was trying to tell me was that there was something standing in the way of my spiritual life. And it boiled down to the fact that resentments was one of them. The other one was the fears in my life, and the other one was the unresolved wrongs that I'd done to other people. And Joe pointed out to me that the big book tells you when they tell you something that's wrong, they always give you a solution. And I found that to be true. So I began to do the things. And I started to do one of those little laugh histories, and Joe would keep trying to get me to show me what I was doing wrong and trying to help me. And I'd say, Joe, I don't know how to do the fourth step. And he said, you will when you do it. And that went along, and I began to do those things. And I did what those steps. And I didn't do a laugh history, and I certainly did, with his help, I did that inventory. And once I had done that inventory, there was something happened, and I saw who Leon McGarity was. And I accepted Leon McGarity, that this is the meatball that I'm working with here, and if I can take this and give it to other people as they tell me, I'll sure be happy to do it if I can keep doing like I'm doing. The other strange thing that happened was when I saw what I was and what my part of was of my selfishness and my self-centeredness. My part of it was being selfish, self-centered, fearful, and dishonest. And I could look across the street at you that I never liked before the way you wore your hat or because you had a mustache or something like that. That I could see you as being motivated by the same things that motivated me. That you're also selfish, you're also self-seeking, you're also dishonest, and you're also fearful. But we'll always be selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, fearful, and those things. Bill Wilson, at the top of the fourth step of the fourth step in the 12 by 12, mentions the fact that God gave us those instincts for a purpose. And I looked on that as being something that you level, which is the seeds to pride. And by leveling those things and keeping them within their proper bounds, the instincts are there for a purpose. And as long as I can see my instincts, I can see yours. And as long as I can do those things, then I can say I love you. And I think when one person can say to everybody in this world, we used to have a guy in our country said he called himself Big and Friendly Morgan, ain't mad at nobody. And I always thought that is one hell of a good attitude to be in. And I always wanted to be that way. I always loved that bumper sticker that I'm not prejudiced, I hate everybody. The other one was that when I die, I want to be buried face down because there's some invitations out there that they haven't been able to accept the invitation yet. And that was my attitude when I come here. But just doing those steps, those things turned. And I hear people say that they hadn't been as close to God as they should be. I'm not much for poetry and feelings and things like that, but I've got a little piece of poetry here that I'm going to end with. Thank God, somebody say. that illustrates this more than anything that I have ever seen in my life. And I learned this when I was back in the fourth grade and at about fifth, sixth grade or something like that. And it tells me about who is closest to God and who, maybe whether I'm close to God or whether I'm not. And there's a poem called Abub and Adam, and I bet most of you know it. And it's by James Henry Lee Hunt. And it goes that Abub and Adam, may his tribe increase. Awoke one night from a deep dream of peace and saw within the moonlight of his room making it rich like a lily in bloom, an angel writing in a book of gold. Exceeding peace had made Ben Adam bold. And to the presence in the room he said, what writest thou? The vision raised its head, and with a look made of all sweet accord, answered, the names of those who love the Lord. And his mind won, said Abu, nay, not so, replied the angel. And Abu spoke more low, but cheerily still, and said, I pray thee then, write me as one who loves his fellow men. The angel wrote and vanished, and the next night he came again in a great awakening light, and showed the names whom the love of God had blessed, and lo, Ben Adam's name led all the rest. Thank you all. It's been a wonderful weekend. Hope I haven't kept you too long. Thank you so much.